Court number one at the Old Bailey in central London is the most famous courtroom in the world, the venue for many of the most sensational criminal trials in history. On top of the domed building, a bronze statue of Lady Justice holds a sword in her right hand and the scales of justice in her left. From the cells in the bowels of the building, a wiry man in an oversized grey suit is led by a policeman up a narrow, dark staircase. Pens are neatly lined in his breast pocket. The defendant emerges into the bright white light of the courtroom and is greeted by a row of somber faces. The charges are so sensitive, there's no jury. On the bench sits Judge Lord Rayner Goddard, a man with a fearsome reputation and a firm advocate of capital punishment. He describes himself as an avenging enemy of criminals and a vigilant Lord Protector of society. As the defendant takes this all in, he briefly touches his breast pocket to feel the neat line of pens stored there. But as Klaus Fuchs looks around the court, he's not the only man with shredded nerves. Unbeknown to him, the prosecution's case against him is precarious. For 8 years, he was spying for the Soviet Union, handing them all the secrets he could as an atomic physicist inside the British and American nuclear bomb programs. The main indisputable evidence against Fuchs is too secret to be revealed. He may have confessed, but even that is not watertight. If he now pleads not guilty, he will almost certainly walk free. Failure would be a catastrophe for the British establishment and for the already fragile British-American alliance. Tension crackles throughout the courtroom. Fuchs listens as indictments for 4 breaches of the Official Secrets Act are read to him. Judge Goddard asks Klaus Fuchs to enter his plea. He leans forward to speak, and Washington and Whitehall hold their breath. From the BBC World Service, I'm Rosa Ellis, and this is Season 2 of The Bomb. Episode 9, Dead Cat, Live Cat. The unravelling of Klaus Fuchs's years of espionage happens slowly and then all at once. On the 24th of January 1950, MI5's chief interrogator, Jim Scarden, steps off the train at Didcot in Oxfordshire. It's cold and wet, and a cloak of grey hangs in the air. He's met by Wing Commander Henry Arnold, head of security at Harwell, Britain's most important nuclear research facility. Only the day before, Arnold called Scarden, saying that Fuchs is ready to talk, and talk a lot. On the car ride to Harwell, a sense of anticipation fills the silence. At Harwell, Scarden walks alone to the door of Fuchs's prefab house.
You asked to see me.
Yes. It is rather up to me now.
Scarden is surprised by Fuchs's appearance.
He was pale. He was agitated. He had a very different look than Scarden had seen at any other time when they had met.
And it's not only Fuchs that's different. In the 3 previous meetings, the room had been bugged. On this occasion, Scarden has requested that nobody listen to or record the conversation. It may cause embarrassment, he says. But embarrassing to whom? That's the question. Fuchs offers Scarden a seat, stokes the fire, and then sits down himself. He starts going through the whole backstory once again. His battles with Nazi students, his horror of Hitler's invasion of Russia, and his internment by the British. All the way up to his love of the job at Harwell. Biographer Nancy Thorndike Greenspan.
So Scarden, having listened to all this patiently, asked Klaus about his actions. He, you know, knew his history, but what were his actions?
Skadden adopts a reassuring and friendly tone. He encourages Fuchs to relieve his conscience and unburden himself. But Fuchs is in internal turmoil.
Come on, Klaus. It'll be so much simpler if you get it off your chest.
And Klaus responded,
I will never be persuaded by you to talk.
Both men know why they're here, but Fuchs can't bring himself to deliver the final blow. Skadden realises they've reached a dead end and suggests they break and go for lunch. Fuchs knows a hotel restaurant in neighbouring Abingdon and leads Skadden out to his MG sports car. He drives like a madman, missing cars by inches. Skadden holds on for dear life. When they get to the hotel, lunch is punctuated by awkward small talk about life at Harwell. When they finish their coffee, Fuchs suddenly stands up.
Let's go back.
This time, to Skadden's great relief, Fuchs drives slowly. He seems calm and collected. Something shifted. They walk in silence back into Fuchs's living room. And as they settle back into their seats, Skadden fixes Fuchs with his gaze and asks,
when did it start?
Fuchs meets his stare. There's a moment's pause. And then he says,
about the middle of 1942. And it continued until about a year ago.
Basically, Klaus just started opening up. And he launched into a confession about his spying. And he told Skadden that the biggest, most important thing was that he'd given the Russians the plans to the plutonium bomb when he was at Los Alamos.
Skadden's pen hovers over his notepad. He tries to contain himself as the full significance of what he's been told finally hits home. Klaus Fuchs has just admitted to providing the Russians with the full technical designs for the atomic bomb. The very same bomb the Russians have successfully exploded 5 months previously.
MI5, nor Skadden, nor anybody else had any idea that his spying had been that serious. They thought it had basically been about the gaseous diffusion project in New York when he was doing the research there. And this was a complete surprise to them.
Skadden struggles to keep up, scribbling furiously as Fuchs talks. As the sun dips below the horizon, they finally wrap up. Skadden thanks Fuchs, and when he leaves, he heads straight to Arnold's office to call MI5 HQ and let them know that Fuchs has made a full confession.
The main goal for Skadden and everybody else, including those like Henry Arnold at Harwell, was to maintain Klaus Fuchs in his present state of mind. That's a quote. So they were just kind of keeping calm, keeping level, and just going forward to get whatever they could out of him.
When Fuchs meets again with Skadden a couple of days later, his priority is to ensure he can stay at Harwell. Skadden's priority is to maintain Fuchs's trust and to get him to agree to signing a written confession. It's a balancing act that will determine Fuchs's whole future. After the meeting, Fuchs calls his lover, Erna Skinner, and tells her it's all under control. In reality, it's anything but. The next day, he travels to London and meets Skadden at Paddington Station. They walk to the nearby War Office and go to room 055. Fuchs dictates his statement and signs it. Among the pages of confession, there are only two sentences on spying.
When I learned the nature of the work, I decided to inform Russia and I established contact through another member of the Communist Party. Since that time, I have had continuous contact with persons who were completely unknown to me, except that I knew that they would hand over whatever information I gave to them to the Russian authorities.
At this point, Fuchs seems to relax. He appears to be confident that his job at Harwell is secure and there's not going to be any punishment. That night, he heads to the Skinners and stays until the early hours of the morning. But within a week, Fuchs is back on a train to London. He's been called in by Sir Michael Perrin, Deputy Director of the British Atomic Bomb Project. Fuchs has already given him a detailed technical breakdown of his espionage, and he has no reason to expect anything untoward. But he's walking straight into a trap. The meeting has really been set up at the request of Commander Burt from Scotland Yard, the police headquarters in London. The experience proves a very stressful one for Michael Perrin.
The trouble was that Fuchs arrived dead on time and Commander Burt didn't. I think it must have been about half an hour before he arrived with his number two. And by that time, I was getting really worried because I'd had to ring through to my secretary to tell Fuchs, please, I'm engaged in a very difficult meeting. Would he mind waiting a bit longer?
Perrin has agreed with Commander Burt that he will get Fuchs to his office, but only on condition that when the two men meet, he won't be present himself. He's a scientist, not a copper. And now he's sweating it out, with Fuchs patiently sitting on the other side of the door.
So I was rather cross with Commander Burt when he came in. I said, why are you late? He said, well, I've been around the Foreign Office. They can't get settled between themselves and Washington the exact wording of the charge. But we've got it now.
After more than half an hour, Fuchs is finally called in. But he stops in his tracks when he sees a policeman standing there. Perrin is just feet away, listening from the neighbouring room, as Commander Burt reads Fuchs the charges against him.
And then Burt came back and said, he would like to see you. So I said, all right, well, I'll come in. And he just looked at me, looked terribly shaken, but he just looked at me and said, you realise what this would mean for Harwell?
Whether due to hubris, delusion or deceit, Klaus Fuchs had been convinced that his life's work at Harwell was secure. The reality of his fate now comes crashing down around him. And by that evening, newspapers on both sides of the Atlantic are plastered with details of his arrest. It's shocking news for most, but for some, it comes as a dagger to the heart.
I mean, they both were absolutely devastated.
Joe Hookway's parents, Rudolph and Genia Piles, are completely blindsided by the news. They had taken Fuchs into their home, and it was Rudolph who brought him into the British atomic bomb programme in the first place and then ensured that he went to New York and Los Alamos.
He was surprised. He had assumed there was some kind of mistake or that Fuchs had had some kind of breakdown, and that was the reason behind it.
The next morning, Rudolph Piles passes through the high red brick walls of Brixton Prison in South London. His chest is tight with disbelief. He finds his old friend, Klaus Fuchs, prisoner number 944, on suicide watch.
Hello.
An officer leads Fuchs and Piles, two of the most accomplished and respected atomic physicists in the country, along the prison corridor and into a meeting room. An MI5 officer, a policeman and a prison warden sit in, but they can only snatch snippets as Piles and Fuchs murmur across the table to one another. Piles offers to help him in any way he can and quizzes his old friend about what on earth is going on.
I think it was clear once he visited him in jail that Fuchs knew what he was doing. My mother was absolutely devastated.
Genia Piles had mothered Fuchs like a second son. She'd given him a nickname, Penny in a Slot Fuchs, because he was so shy, she had to ply him with questions to tease out any response. When Rudolph gives her the rundown from his meeting with Fuchs in prison, she is both hurt and angry. So she puts pen to paper to write a brutally honest letter. Her early life was shaped by the Russian Revolution, making the betrayal all the more painful.
My Russian childhood and youth taught me not to trust anybody, and to expect anyone and everyone to be a communist agent. 20 years of freedom in England softened me somewhat, and I learned to like and trust people, Or at any rate, some of them. I certainly did trust you.
Fuchs's arrest has cast a long shadow of suspicion over foreign scientists. None more so than Genia's German-Jewish husband, Rudolf Piles. Genia acknowledges that Fuchs may have changed his views on the Soviet Union, but now the responsibility rests with him to make right his wrong and cooperate in every way he can with the authorities.
Don't stop halfway now. You're not soft, and not one for an easy way out. You're a mathematician. This problem has no rigorous solution. Try to find the best approximation. Oh, Klaus, my tears are washing away the ink. I was so very fond of you, and I so much wanted you to be happy. Now you never will be. You're now going through the hardest time a man can go through. You have burned your God. God help you.
Genia pulls no punches in her letter, but Fuchs doesn't want reassurance. He wants honesty.
Many, many thanks for your letter. Funny that women see such things so much clearer than men.
Fuchs reads and rereads Genia's letter in prison as he awaits trial and ponders his options. He assures Genia that he knows he has to take responsibility and face square on what lies ahead. Whatever compromises he may have previously entertained are no longer an option.
I know that it is my job to try and clear up the mess I have made. I am afraid I did shirk it at first, and that made the mess even worse. They gave me a much easier way out. I could have left Harwell to go to the University a free man. I could have even have stayed in Harwell if I had admitted just one little thing and kept quiet about everything else. I bungled the take your life stage. Yes, I went through that too, before the arrest.
Fuchs can do nothing but wait for his trial now. But outside the prison walls, a whole whirlwind of controversy and subterfuge is raging. The case has exploded in the American press, and members of Congress are rallying behind the prevailing anti-British sentiment. America is in the grips of anti-communist hysteria, and the paranoid head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, is only too happy to shift all blame onto the Brits. So MI5 desperately need to cover their backs. Intelligence expert Nigel West.
The issue was to conceal the truth from Clement Attlee, the Prime Minister.
Members of MI5 top brass know they have personally slipped up and covered up on numerous occasions. A whole wardrobe full of skeletons threatened to come tumbling out and embarrass the British security services.
MI5 senior management and the other parties involved clubbed together to apply pressure on the Director General to mislead the Prime Minister, which is exactly what he did.
Director General Percy Sillitoe informs Clement Attlee that the agency was completely thrown by the revelations of Klaus Fuchs's links to the Soviet Union. He tells him there's no way they could have known. Attlee buys it and defends the security services in Parliament, saying, there was no means by which we could have found out about this man.
Percy Sillitoe was so angry about the way that he had been bamboozled into misleading the Prime Minister that he gathered together the entire MI5 staff in the canteen on the top floor of Leconfield House, the MI5 headquarters in London, and said that he had just lied to the Prime Minister in order to save MI5's future and that he would never do so again.
MI5's fibs and failures aren't their only problem. The sole piece of evidence they have is watertight, but it's also so secret that it can't be used in court. The Venona cables, intercepted Soviet messages, are still being worked on by codebreakers in the US to root out spies who are still active there. In order not to compromise that mission, the decoded message that revealed the existence of Agent Rest has to remain under wraps. So now, the whole case hinges on Fuchs's confession. On Wednesday, the 1st of March, 1950, Klaus Fuchs waits in the holding cells under court number one at the Old Bailey.
It was like a dream. I was in a psychologically difficult state as I was led up to the trial. The final bit was a staircase upward, which led up to the dock.
As Fuchs steps from the dark stairwell into the light of the court, there's an icy silence, and all eyes are fixed on him. Barristers for the defence and prosecution are decked in their wigs and gowns, and the infamous Judge Goddard looks down from the bench with an imperious glare. Sober stares from MI5 and the government representatives veil their fears that the case hangs on the finest of threads. Dozens of journalists crowd the gallery, their pens poised in anticipation. Klaus Fuchs is read the four charges against him. For each one, he's asked what he pleads. He leans forward, and the court is frozen in anticipation. In a low, almost imperceptible whisper, he says,
"Guilty."
Guilty. The clenched jaws of MI5's men slacken, but just a little. They're not home and dry yet. In one short paragraph of the confession, Fuchs specifically admits spying for the Russians. But there's another equally important line that could unravel the whole case. Fuchs said,
"I was given a chance of admitting it and staying at Harwell or clearing out."
The prosecuting barrister references this line as he lays out his case. Judge Goddard snaps across the bench. Does he mean this was in his own mind? And without missing a beat, the prosecution replies, "My lord, that is what he seems to have understood. It's not a correct account of what happened, but that is what he appears to have understood."
So they just lied. They lied that he had not been promised anything. So the judge, you know, dismissed it.
Skardon made sure that his fourth meeting with Fuchs wasn't recorded. He said it could cause embarrassment. It was in this meeting that Fuchs confessed.
Why didn't Skardon want that meeting recorded? Every other interrogation was. Why did he ask? And why was it at that one that Fuchs had confessed? They'd lied about prosecuting him. It was the one interview, the one interrogation that was not recorded. And it's the one where he confesses.
And it's not just the recording of that meeting that's missing. There are three versions of the confession in the public domain, but there's a fourth, longer confession, which has never been released.
There is something at the end of that document that the British government has decided, even as of today, they do not want released, because I asked for it and I was not given it on the basis that it was not going to be given out. So whatever is on the end of that document, it must be some very strong language that Skardon made promises to Klaus.
We've also asked MI5 for this document, but to no avail. If Skardon did offer to wipe the slate clean and allow Fuchs to keep his post at Harwell, Fuchs could be forgiven for believing him. Similar deals were being cut with other Soviet spies. Exactly what Skardon promised in exchange for the confession remains a mystery. But at this moment, for Klaus Fuchs, it's all academic. His fate was sealed as soon as he walked into the courtroom. In 88 short minutes, the trial is over. Judge Goddard is visibly frustrated that he can't prosecute him for treason and pass down the death penalty. He settles for the longest sentence he can give. 14 years. Fuchs stands frozen. The thought of years ahead filled with nothingness has turned him cold. A warder nudges him into motion, and as he's led away from the dock, down into the cells, spots of colour flush into his pale cheeks. The journalists crammed into the viewing gallery scramble to file their stories. The conviction will make headlines around the world. Klaus Fuchs is 38 years old as he's transferred to Wormwood Scrubs Prison to begin his new life as an inmate.
In the beginning, when I was in solitary confinement during my daily walk, I was only allowed to walk together with a murderer. He was, of course, no partner of conversation.
Fuchs counts his steps as he walks around the Oval Exercise Yard. He notes that the number of steps correlates to his mood. Fewer steps reflects a better mood.
I try to think through all the questions. First, to prepare myself for 14 years. How many days are these? How many hours? What do you do with that time? Well, because you need to find a meaning for what you do under these circumstances. The people you have there, in the prison, the prisoners, you have to try to help these unhappy people, because they are mainly unhappy people who get into prison, and through helping them, to gain respect among the prisoners. I succeeded. And I believe that is also what helped me to get over this time.
Fuchs stands out among the prisoners. As well as sewing mattresses with his fellow inmates, he also reads everything he can get his hands on and discusses philosophy and economics with the prison warden. And over time, he wins the affection of both the guards and the prisoners. Among the men he shares the wing with is Archie Hill, a criminal from the Black Country in the Midlands, whose brutal upbringing had morphed into a blurred mess of alcoholism, homelessness and prison time.
I think both being in prison and in mental institutions where I've been committed for alcoholism, you enter a vacuum. I realised that I was going to rot in prison, and that was the sum total of my prison existence. And having decided that, established it in my mind, I then had to take steps to prevent the rotting taking place.
But it's Klaus Fuchs who helps Archie Hill as he struggles to turn his life around.
Doc Fuchs, we called him in the prison. He was way above me, obviously, intellectually. But his influences, when I came into contact with him, he was a Blue Band trustee, which gave him the run of the prison. And I found him quiet, introspective, but very warm and friendly. And there were lots of seeds he planted in my mind. Music, poetry, Tolstoy's War and Peace. I read that for the first and only time in prison.
Through helping men like Archie Hill, Klaus Fuchs finds meaning to his life behind bars. But the consequences of his espionage are far from resolved. He may be locked up, but MI5 and the FBI are not done with him yet. They want names, details of everyone he's worked with over the years, and they're prepared to use whatever leverage they can to get him to cooperate. His mentally unwell sister Crystal, Harry Gold, and my great aunt Ursula, their lives are in his hands now. Betraying nations has never been a problem for Klaus Fuchs, but betraying friends, family, or fellow agents is another matter. Fuchs's loyalty to his own conscience is about to be tested, but who will he protect and who will he betray? Next time on The Bomb.
He needed to protect her. He would have done that with his life.
Then when we got off the plane, she told us again, you keep quiet, keep silent.
The British Secret Service just were convinced that my father was as guilty as Fuchs, but they just couldn't prove it.
He simply could have nodded, but he had to say this is true.
You can subscribe to The Bomb on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd leave a rating or a review to help other people find it. The Bomb was presented by me, Rosa Ellis. It was written and produced by Zach Brophy. The story editor was Emma Harding. Alice McKee was the assistant producer. Our producer in Berlin was Sabine Scherek. Klaus Fuchs was played by Marcus Calvin, and Klaus Kutowski by Wolf Kahler. Eugenia Piles was Madlena Nadeva, with additional performances by David Hounslow. Original music was composed by Trevor Gorekis, with additional original music by Ben Marshall. Sound design was by Tim Nielsen at Skywalker Sound and Eloise Whitmore. The executive producer was Glyn Tansley, and the podcast was commissioned by Simon Pitts at the BBC World Service.